From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Laura Kanoy, and this is The Exchange. With 2020 on track to be one of the warmest years ever, this hour on The Exchange, we look at how the presidential candidates are talking about climate change. Democratic nominee Joe Biden has a $2 trillion plan aimed at zero emissions by the year 2050. President Trump doesn't have a specific approach written down. Instead, his campaign points to executive orders, such as his Trillion Trees initiative, and his decision to withdraw from the Paris Climate Accord. We'll explore these positions and later look at policies put forward by New Hampshire's candidates for governor. Our program is part of NHPR's By Degrees Climate Reporting Project. And as always, Exchange listeners, we love hearing from you. How do you want candidates to talk about this issue? What policies appeal most to you? Email us. It's exchange@nhpr.org. Once again, exchange@nhpr.org. Use Facebook or call 1-800-892-6477. With us for the hour, Andy Ropeek, NHPR's climate and energy reporter. She's leading the By Degrees Climate Initiative. And with us for our presidential overview is Rebecca Hersher. She's a reporter on NPR's Science Desk, where she covers outbreaks, natural disasters, environmental and health research. Well, welcome to both of you. And Annie, let's start with you. And before we get into the policies, how important, Annie, is this for New Hampshire voters right now? Because there's certainly a lot of other problems in front of us.
Absolutely. I mean, it's clearly been a top priority issue for voters here since the presidential primary, you know, oh so long ago. I think that we have polling data to suggest that this issue has only become a greater priority, especially for Democrats, but also increasingly for Republicans, and even more so for independents, which we have a lot of in this state. So in NHPR's own polling, we've seen this be, you know, consistently in the top three or four issues for many voters. We've heard a lot about it on the campaign trail. We've heard it tied a lot to other issues that are really important here environmentally, like drinking water quality. And, you know, we've seen that people here are, you know, connected to their environment. This is an outdoorsy, sort of environmentally minded state, and people are increasingly connecting that to the effects of climate change. They're seeing that we're in a drought right now. They're seeing the changing temperatures and snow patterns, and they understand that this is happening, and they want to know what candidates federally, but, you know, increasingly at the state level too, are going to do about it.
So even with the pandemic, Annie, climate change hasn't gotten crowded out?
Well, I don't want to say that. I think, you know, definitely is competing for airtime. I think, you know, the biggest thing is that the pandemic has just underscored the importance of so many other issues, and climate change is definitely one of those. So the importance of a robust public health system, the sort of inequalities we see in how environmental conditions, any other kind of factors will affect people of color, low-income communities differently. We've seen, you know, people rethinking whether they need to be driving to work, rethinking sort of how they handle trash in their home. So it does sort of like bring this issue out at every level. I think on the campaign trail, it has obviously gotten less attention than the pandemic. Most things have, but sure, as we'll talk about later in the governor's race, for example, you know, this is still one of the top things they're differentiating themselves on. So it still comes up.
And what's the partisan gap on this issue, Annie? You touched on it, but I'd like to hear a little more.
Yeah, so, I mean, Democrats overwhelmingly believe in climate change, support policies to do things about it. The Yale Program on Climate Change Communication has done great polling on this for a long time, and they find that, you know, all measures of support for climate action for Democrats are in the, you know, mid to upper 90% range, and that holds true in New Hampshire. For independents, it's ticking up. It's, you know, definitely a majority now in the 60s and 70s, and then the sort of farther right you get, the lower those percentages get. But even in New Hampshire now, according to Yale, more than 50% of Republicans believe in climate change, and close to 80% support funding for renewable energy development, which is one of the sort of most popular policy ideas across the political spectrum. So we're pretty in line with the national picture, and that partisan divide still exists, but it's shrinking.
Well, and Rebecca, how about you? What about nationally? Same questions I asked Annie, please. Where this issue ranks for voters this year? And what's the partisan divide at the national level, Rebecca?
Well, it's a good question because Americans have changed over the last decade or so. So right now, and I like to look at Pew, they do a lot of polling on this. They did a poll this summer. the majority of registered voters nationwide say climate change is either very or somewhat important to them, specifically when they're deciding who to vote for president. So that's a lot of people, you know, that is the majority of Americans saying that climate change is helping them decide who to cast their ballot for. And when you look at the partisan divide, those latest numbers from Pew, they don't look at Republicans and Democrats. They look at people who intend to vote for Vice President Biden versus people who intend to vote for President Trump. And there is a giant gap there. So even though you see a smaller gap between Democrats and Republicans in many parts of the country, you see 68% of people who support Biden say that climate change is very important to them when they decide who to vote for president. Only 11% of people who support Trump feel that way.
Well, let's talk about what the two presidential candidates are saying. And let's start with the Trump administration. So to set this up, let's hear President Trump's response to a question about his climate policies if reelected. This audio is from the presidential debate on October 22nd.
So we have the Trillion Trees program. We have so many different programs. I do love the environment, but what I want is the cleanest, crystal clear water, the cleanest air. We have the best, lowest number in carbon emissions, which is a big standard that I notice Obama goes with all the time. Not Joe. I haven't heard Joe use the term because I'm not sure he knows what it represents or means, but I have heard Obama use it. And we have the best carbon emission numbers that we've had in 35 years under this administration. We are working so well with industry, but here's what we can't do. Look at China, how filthy it is. Look at Russia. Look at India. It's filthy. The air is filthy. The Paris Accord, I took us out because we were going to have to spend trillions of dollars, and we were treated very unfairly. When they put us in there, they did us a great disservice. They were going to take away our businesses.
Okay, so there's a lot to unpack there from that clip from the president in their last presidential debate. And first, Rebecca Hersher, the Paris Accord. Now, this is often portrayed as a symbol or a litmus test of commitment to combating climate change. But beyond the symbolism, Rebecca, how significant is this accord to actually cutting emissions, to making a real difference?
It's a good question. So the way to think about the Paris Agreement is that it's both important and it's insufficient. And that tension is present in all of our conversations about what the agreement is and what it does, right? So the commitments that countries have made, including the US, it involves giving money, if you're a rich country, to poorer countries to help them adapt their economies. And that is actually a really big deal. So especially if richer countries like the US were to follow through with all of the funding they've promised, and the US has not, that would be really game-changing for countries that are rapidly growing. We're talking about countries like India, for example, that are burning a lot of coal right now, that don't have the resources to transition their economy to a cleaner fuel. And that money could help them transition. It could also help them deal with the effects of climate change, right? So you have a lot of economies all over the world that are burning a lot of coal, that are also dealing with sea level rise. And they need to figure out how to use limited resources to address both problems. And the US could help with that. But, so that's on the money side. But when we talk about the actual promises that have been made, they are insufficient. So the way the Paris Agreement works, countries make promises to reduce emissions, and the goal is to keep global warming below 2 degrees Celsius compared to pre-industrial temperatures. Here's the thing. The Earth has already warmed about 1 degree, and we're not on track with the promises that have been made to hit that less than 2 degree target. And scientists say that we really need to limit warming to more like 1.5 degrees or less if we want to avoid the most catastrophic effects of a hotter planet. So Paris, right now, the agreement is not sufficient to address the problem, but it's still a really important piece of the puzzle.
Well, sure. So correct me if I'm wrong, Rebecca. If the U.S. had stayed into Paris, it would have had to have cut greenhouse gas emissions by at least 26% in 5 years from 2005 levels. Rebecca, when I read that, I thought, hang on, we were probably emitting a fair bit of greenhouse gases back in 2005. Like, that doesn't sound very robust, to be honest.
Yeah, and that's the right reaction. It's not a particularly robust promise, and we're not on track to meet it. You know, the best estimates right now are that we're on track to reduce by about 17% if we stay on the track that we're on. So it's really not enough to avoid those catastrophic effects that scientists just keep warning us about.
Well, and Annie, to you, how do climate activists that you talk to here in New Hampshire view this Paris Accord?
I think that they are on the same page as Rebecca just outlined. You know, it's almost a gimme. It's like, this is the very least that we could be doing. We've seen people talk about this as something that they expect a nominee to do if they support climate action, and they certainly expect them to do much more than that. It is a good symbol for folks that believe in climate action, and it is very global. So it's certainly not the, you know, alpha and omega of what people are interested in seeing, but I think folks would be surprised if it wasn't on the climate plan of someone that they supported. And I mean, notably, we haven't seen that much activity in New Hampshire around these local pledges to follow the Paris Accords. There, you know, has been some of that, but not as high profile as in cities like Pittsburgh, which really like led that effort nationally. So this hasn't been a huge part of the conversation here. I think people just sort of assume that anyone who is serious about climate change will do that as a first step and then kind of get to work.
And Rebecca, to you, what does the president mean in that clip when he says Paris would have taken away our businesses? This is an argument that, you know, others have made, that Paris would have hurt American companies. What's the sort of the substance of that?
You know, I think there's a section of American political leaders who look at these international agreements, and what they see is an attack on sovereignty, that, you know, you're making a promise along with other countries to do things that are hard and that require the economy to change wholesale. And, you know, the American economy has a lot of things in it that are dependent on fossil fuels. You know, we have a large and growing domestic oil and gas production sector. And that is really scary to imagine that some of the promises we've made under this Paris Agreement will require us to change the way that sector looks. Now, what economists will tell you is that actually transitioning the economy to a cleaner economy doesn't have to be a long-term cost. It can be a long-term benefit. But it's hard to imagine that future, I think. And, you know, in the short term, it can be really scary.
Well, and we'll talk a little bit later about the cost of Joe Biden's plan, and also the cost that some economists are calculating, the cost of doing nothing. But a couple more questions about the president's approach. And Rebecca, to you again, please. He talked in that clip we just heard about having, quote, the best carbon emissions in 35 years. Is that true?
That is an interesting question. So it depends on how you measure. So because of the pandemic, emissions of CO2 and methane, that's what we mean when we talk about carbon, they're down all over the world this year, including in the U.S.
Because no one's flying anywhere. And yeah, go ahead.
Exactly. Yeah. And people aren't out and about, like productivity is down in a lot of places. So if you look at the initial estimates of how much emissions are down in the U.S. because of the pandemic, they're at a multi-decade low. That is what the president is talking about. That said, you know, I'm a science reporter. The numbers are only as good as their context. So it's important to say that U.S. emissions, they've been dropping slowly but steadily since the early 2000s. And since the president took office, emissions have gone up slightly. Like, if not for the pandemic, he could not have made this claim and had it been accurate. In fact, his administration's policies have allowed more carbon pollution from cars, from trucks, from power plants, from oil and gas operations. So it really depends on whether you're zooming in on this statement or whether you are zooming out.
Well, and I want to remind listeners that you can join us as we talk about the presidential candidates, what they're saying about climate change this election season. It's part of NHPR's By Degrees Climate Reporting Initiative. We welcome your questions. What policies do you want to hear about? What seems to make sense to you? Send us an email. It's exchange@nhpr.org. Once again, exchange@nhpr.org, or give us a call, 1-800-892-6477. And Annie, as we talk about the president's approach, and then we will turn to Vice President Biden's approach, the president doesn't have a specific climate plan per se. Rather, under the campaign website's promises kept portion, it lists policies it considers environmental successes. Among them are the rollbacks of environmental regulations and pulling out of Paris. And there is, Annie, the 1 trillion trees initiative. So just back up, Annie, please remind us How much trees affect the climate calculation? Do they play a big role? Do they play a small role?
Yeah, I love Rebecca's line about that, you know, the numbers are only as good as their context. The Trillion Trees Initiative is controversial because it sounds great, and trees are really important for fighting climate change, nature-based solutions generally, any sort of grasslands or forests, even ocean water that absorb carbon dioxide, you know, can be used as a tool to absorb carbon from the atmosphere and absorb new emissions and help us reduce warming. So planting new forests or preserving existing forests definitely has a huge role to play here. This is something we hear a lot about in New Hampshire because we're so heavily forested. But, you know, there are limitations here, and certainly just planting trees or preserving trees is nowhere near enough to achieve the kind of reductions that we're talking about when it comes to things like Paris. So, for example, the UN panel on climate change that produced that landmark report that sort of set the benchmarks for all of the goals that we're talking about said that nature-based solutions could meet up to about a third of the goals of Paris, but that's everything across the board, including trees. And that's only a third of the goals of Paris, which, as we've just heard, you know, have their own shortcomings. So it's going to be part of the solution. And there are other policymakers who talk about this issue, but it's certainly not the end-all be-all of what needs to happen.
Well, and if listeners are interested in that issue, the Trillion Trees Initiative, we did do a whole show on this topic back in February, and there's a link to that show on the web post for today's show at nhpr.org/exchange. Rebecca, what kind of energy policies does President Trump say he'll pursue if he's reelected? Because this is also part of the climate calculation.
Well, he's signaled that he will continue with the policies of his first term. So that includes rolling back emission standards for cars and trucks. Trucks are a particularly large source of emissions in this country. And so that's a pretty big deal. The administration is in a fight with California right now over those standards. Doubling down on domestic oil and gas production, logging. So on the trees front, you know, the administration authorized logging in a national forest in Alaska just this week, and also trying to save what is left of the U.S. coal industry. So it's really, it's the same as we've been seeing for the last 4 years, and it's also very similar to the types of energy policies that the U.S. has pursued really over the last century, which is striking since we're in this situation where the climate is clearly changing and so many people around the world are calling for a new way forward.
Well, that brings up Joe Biden's statement recently during a debate that he would transition away from oil, and that caused some controversy. Vice President Biden has also said he would not stop fracking. Some people see that as a ploy to get the Pennsylvania vote. But let's talk about energy policies between these two candidates, including what Joe Biden said recently about transitioning away from oil. And just to start this off, let's hear a little bit from this interaction on energy policy at the last presidential debate.
I have one final
question.
Would
he close down the oil industry?
It falls.
Would you close down the oil industry?
By the way, I would transition from the oil industry, yes.
Oh,
I will transition. It is a big statement.
That's a big
statement. Because I would stop.
Why would you do that?
Because the oil industry pollutes significantly.
I see.
Here's the deal. But
that's a big statement.
Well, if you let me finish the statement, because it has to be replaced by renewable energy over time. And I'd stop giving to the oil industry. I'd stop giving them federal subsidies. He won't give federal subsidies to solar and wind.
Yeah.
Why are we giving it to oil industry?
We actually do give it to solar and wind. And that's maybe the biggest statement in terms of business. That's the biggest statement.
Okay.
Because basically what he's saying is he is going to destroy the oil industry.
Okay.
Will you remember that, Texas? Will you remember that, Pennsylvania, Oklahoma?
Vice President Biden, let me give you 10 seconds to respond,
Ohio.
And then I have to get to the final question. Vice President Biden.
He takes everything out of context, but the point is, look, we have to move toward a net zero emissions. The first place to do that by the year 2035 is in energy production. By 2050, totally.
Okay, so Rebecca and Annie, you're going to have to help me figure this out, because on the one hand, we hear Vice President Biden, former Vice President Biden, say we're going to transition from oil. But on the other hand, he has stated his commitment to not stopping fracking. So, Annie, I'll turn to you first, but Rebecca, I want to hear from you too. Annie, just how do environmentalists view these seemingly mixed messages?
Well, I think we're talking about multiple features of the renewable energy transition, right? So, for example, you know, in New England, we have all but transitioned away from coal. There is very little coal burning left in this region. In fact, most of it happens right here in New Hampshire. And that plant has been heavily protested and targeted, you know, in recent years because it is one of the few coal plants left here. When we talk about oil, that is, you know, seen as a dirtier fuel than natural gas. And it's all relative, right? I mean, natural gas still has emissions. There are still plenty of climate risks and issues that come from oil extraction, which is usually in the form of fracking. But natural gas has been seen as a way to at least stop using the dirtier fuels, coal and oil, to lower emissions somewhat. So now natural gas is like the next frontier of lowering emissions. But there are still plenty of people employed in oil extraction, in coal mining, not to mention natural gas. A lot of them happen to live in swing states, as you mentioned. And so all of these jobs will need to be accounted for in moving away from these fuels, which, you know, science says that we really do need to do just generally. And the question of how we do it is sort of the big question for policymakers. But generally speaking, we should stop burning these fuels if we want to most quickly address climate change. And if we're going to keep burning them, we're going to have to find ways to absorb that carbon or store it so that it doesn't go into the atmosphere and continue contributing to the problem.
Rebecca, how do you hear this line that the Democratic nominee Joe Biden is trying to walk on fossil fuel-based energy?
Well, I think it's interesting because you see the same tension playing out in fossil fuel-producing states, and I've seen this a lot in my reporting, that even within a family in states with big oil and gas industries, you might see people disagreeing on exactly what the solution to the problems that Annie just laid out is. So maybe somebody in a family works at a refinery, has a good paying job, is proud of the work they do. Maybe their spouse or child is being negatively affected by pollution from that same industry. Or maybe the family is struggling with flooding or wildfires as the earth heats up, right? And Americans have been living with this for long enough to connect the dots on that. And it's hard. There are states where fossil fuels are big business and where global warming is having really negative effects. And I think you're seeing that tension that we're seeing in individual households, in cities, and in states play out in the rhetoric that you see Vice President Biden deploying, where he's trying to walk this line saying, I understand that the industries are important, that they're a part of our economy, that they're important for individual families, and we need to find a way to move away from them.
Well, and that brings up what Vice President Biden says is a feature of his plan, and we'll talk about that more after a break. He says that it would include lots of new jobs. So we'll hear a little bit of that. We'll also talk more with you guys about it. And we'll hear from our listeners. Our phone number is 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Again, coming up, more on what the presidential campaigns are saying about climate. A little bit later, we'll look at this issue in the New Hampshire governor's race. All that's coming up. Stay with us. This is The Exchange on NHPR.
Fall cleanup projects around the house can be a lot of work, with leaves to rake, gutters to clean, and wood to stack. But donating that old vehicle you no longer use to NHPR is as easy as pumpkin pie. Free up some space in your garage this autumn, all while supporting the public radio programs you rely on. We'll take care of the paperwork and even arrange to tow away your old car, truck, or boat for free. Learn more today at nhpr.org/cardonation.
This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today, what the presidential candidates are saying about climate change. It's part of NHPR's By Degrees climate reporting project. And a little bit later, we'll turn to the discussion on this issue in New Hampshire's gubernatorial race. Let's get your thoughts in, Exchange listeners. What policies do you want to hear about in this year's campaigns for president and for governor? Send us an email. It's exchange@nhpr.org. Use Facebook or call in 1-800-892-6477. And Rebecca Hersher, Annie Ropeek, just before the break, we heard President Trump make the case that Joe Biden's plan to reduce use of fossil fuels would hurt jobs. Let's now hear the Democratic nominee Joe Biden make the case in that same debate that tackling climate change is actually good for jobs in the economy.
Climate change and climate warming, the global warming, is an existential threat to humanity. We have a moral obligation to deal with it. And we're told by all the leading scientists in the world, we don't have much time. We're going to pass the point of no return within the next 8 to 10 years. 4 more years of this man eliminating all the regulations that were put in by us to clean up the climate, to limit emissions, will put us in a position where we're going to be in real trouble. Here's where we have a great opportunity. I was able to get both all the environmental organizations as well as labor, the people worried about jobs, to support my climate plan. Because what it does, it will create millions of new good-paying jobs.
Again, that's Democratic nominee, former Vice President Joe Biden, talking about his climate plan. And as we said earlier, both of you, the estimated cost of this plan is almost $2 trillion. Rebecca Hersher, that's a lot of money. The government is already in record debt due to spending on coronavirus relief. Does the Biden campaign, Rebecca, spell out where the money's going to come from?
Not exactly. But it does lay out a path forward that involves taxes and involves incentives for new industries to pull in funding while taxing industries that have released a lot of pollution. I think that the money itself actually is not, they haven't said over what period of time they would spend it. And so it remains to be seen how much money would need to be found immediately.
I see. So it's not $2 trillion all at once. And often these big mega plans, right, Rebecca, are sort of, you know, X amount of money over 10 years.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. Yeah. And, you know, it's important to remember that the costs of not spending this money are really big. And this is something that scientists have studied a lot. So we've already racked up. We can look at what's happening right now. The country has experienced more than $500 billion in losses directly from climate-fueled weather disasters. So that's, you know, wildfires, wetter, more intense hurricanes, floods, heat waves. And that's over the last 5 years. It doesn't include this year, which will be tens of billions of dollars. And the Earth is still getting hotter. This is just the beginning. So the National Climate Assessment, the most recent one, they actually estimated how much climate change will cost the U.S. economy each year if nothing is done, if we spend no money. And it could be upwards of $500 billion every year. That includes crop damage, that includes lost labor because of heat waves, it includes storm damage. And at that rate, you would exceed trillions of dollars really quickly.
Well, that's an important point. And Annie, there is so much emphasis on how much does it cost? How much does it cost? What analyses have you looked at, Annie, that have to do with the cost of not doing anything about climate?
Yeah, Rebecca just named some really important ones. The cost of, you know, natural disasters or climate-fueled weather disasters alone is enormous, but there's also some sort of less obvious costs, heat waves, for example, or just the cost of people having to continue to, you know, move their homes, evacuate because of floods, having to deal with increased healthcare costs because of climate effects, because of air pollution, or air quality issues because of, you know, the burning of various fuels. All of those costs play in here. And there is research that looks at the difference just in how much we act to curb emissions and sort of how these different pathways, as they call them, the speed of action and how much we're able to curb emissions, how quickly. Those have different effects. So I'm looking at a Yale article that puts together some research that shows that in the 50 or so American cities that account for a third or so of our population, just in between the sort of worst case scenario emissions pathway where we really do nothing and in fact emissions increase, between that one and the more middle of the road scenario, you have about 9,300 more people die each year as a result of increased heat in those cities.
Yikes.
So these are individual people, right? I mean, it's insane. It's really incredible when you put the statistics in those kinds of contexts, I think, and trillions of dollars can become really hard to wrap your head around, but we are talking about individual people's lives, individual people's livelihoods. You know, there are fishermen in New England who won't be able to make a living because of the way the waters are warming and will need help adapting to that. So this is not just about sort of those frontline workers, the people on, you know, the hurricane affected coasts. It certainly has a lot of costs coming from those places, but these costs really do move all throughout the economy. And I think, you know, Rebecca is correct that the science does show that the cost of doing nothing is far, far greater than the cost of doing literally anything at all.
Well, and Rebecca, as you reported on Biden's climate plan for NPR, and there's a lot in there, just looking at the numbers, Rebecca, the targets, what is maybe one or two pieces that you see as having the most climate bang for the buck?
It's interesting. You know, one of the things that I think doesn't get as much attention, but is really crucial, is just upgrading the electrical grid. And there are a lot of ways to do that. Some of it involves replacing the actual wires. Some of it includes batteries. And a lot of it includes upgrading the sources of the electricity itself. And a lot of that stuff doesn't feel maybe as noticeable or as sexy to normal people, but it's really important and it's crucial to the Biden plan. So if the electricity you use to run your appliances, maybe heat your home or charge your car in the future, if that's coming from things other than fossil fuels and it's being transmitted through wires that conduct it very efficiently and it's being stored in ways that allow us to use sun and wind more efficiently, then emissions will fall really dramatically. And it happens more naturally if you go from the ground up in that way. So even though you hear a lot about things like transitioning cars to being electric, maybe, or even like putting solar panels on houses, the really big ticket items are these grid level items.
That's interesting. That doesn't make as exciting a headline, Rebecca, as sort of, you know, offshore wind or look at this new solar array. But it's,
yeah,
it's there.
Exactly. Yeah, it's a big deal.
Annie, as a climate reporter, what stands out to you from this Joe Biden plan philosophically? Rebecca sort of gave us some of the numbers and specifics, but what's the overall philosophical tone of this plan?
Well, I think it's really all-encompassing. You know, before the presidential primary, I spent a lot of time looking at the different candidates, the different Democratic candidates' plans, and, you know, some of them were a lot shorter than this one. Some of them focused sort of much more narrowly on certain issues like foreign policy or just carbon capture and storage. And, you know, Biden has clearly worked with people on this plan that have tried to bring in all kinds of different issues, from what Rebecca talks about, grid modernization, to cutting carbon emissions just generally, to socioeconomic justice, foreign policy, national security, you know, sort of you name it, it is checked off in here. And he really, you heard it if you watched the debate, that he tries to bring in his sort of credibility on things like economic or environmental justice. You know, he has seen frontline communities in Delaware be affected by pollution from fossil fuel production. I used to work in Delaware. It really is kind of incredible up there in Wilmington. I mean, there are refineries up there and you don't associate that with Delaware, but they really are up there. And that has a health effect on people that live nearby. And so the plan talks a lot about environmental justice. It does talk a lot about adaptation, which can be kind of hard to address. A lot of people think of that as more of a local issue. There's only so much the federal government can kind of provide by way of support and resources on that issue, which really is their role. It's funding, it's insurance programs, it's you know, science to help communities prepare for things like sea level rise. And he talks about all of that in here. It's, you know, it's a very comprehensive plan, and you can tell that he has heard from members of his party that this needs to be a priority. He has listened to folks like the authors of the Green New Deal and worked some of that intersectionalism into this plan. You know, there's threads of socioeconomic justice in here. I'm sure there are, you know, Democrats who believe there could be more of that, but there are certainly nods to it. It's not sort of a niche environmental plan. It has connections to other issues, and I think that's important to a lot of people.
Well, a couple emails I'd like to share with both of you on the presidential race. And then in our last segment, I have lots of emails coming in already about New Hampshire policy. So we'll get to those as well. But while we're talking about the presidential race, Roger in Stratham says, during the Kennedy administration, NASA was 4% of the federal budget. Biden's $2 trillion plan is a little over 5%. And the positive results, Roger says, stay right here on planet Earth. Roger, thank you. Michael emails, climate regulation in the U.S. is admirable, but Even the Obama administration, with John Kerry as Secretary of State, admitted that even if the U.S. reduced our carbon emissions to zero, it would have a negligible effect on rising temperatures without buy-in from China and India. Michael says while we were implementing the Paris Climate Agreement, China was expanding its network of coal-fired power plants. What other proposals being offered to exert pressure on both China and India to change their ways? Michael, thank you. Rebecca, this is a great question, and this has to do with what we were talking about earlier. You know, concerns that Paris really doesn't have that much teeth.
Mm-hmm. And it's an interesting, I think it's a great question. You know, one thing to remember about, I think that comment from the former president is really interesting. One thing to remember about the U.S. is that we exert influence in many ways. You know, the U.S. is a very big and influential economy. And so if the U.S., let's say, were to do what President Obama suggested, what if we reduced our emissions to zero? Well, how would we do that? There would be new technologies that would allow us to do that. And those technologies would get adopted, or you could imagine that they could get adopted by other countries, right? And so in the same way that burning fossil fuels was something that really in many ways came out of the US and spread around the world, if the US were to change its economy fundamentally in that way, you could imagine that that would exert economic pressure on economies like China. And as long as the US isn't doing that, that's one lever we're not pulling when it comes to the influence campaign. There are other levers we could pull. You mentioned that the Biden plan, or Annie mentioned that the Biden plan, you know, talks about foreign policy. That's an important element of it. But it's important to remember the technological leadership element as well.
Well, Michael, thank you for emailing. And Annie and I were talking yesterday about perhaps once the election is over, we can just do a whole show looking at Paris, what it really means, because November 4th actually is the day that the U.S. officially leaves this agreement. So we'll set that aside for now. Rebecca, one last question for you, and then we are going to turn to our gubernatorial discussion. How concerned, Rebecca, are climate activists that if Joe Biden does become president, climate will become more of a back burner issue for him, given the huge burden of the pandemic?
Well, I think climate activists in the U.S. are used to fighting for attention. You know, there's almost always something that's more pressing politically than climate change. It's a slow catastrophe. There is always something, whether it's a new economic meltdown or a political situation, that takes the front page. And so even though it's becoming a more salient problem in the minds of a lot of Americans, as we discussed, even though, you know, people are seeing it in their day-to-day lives, and it's showing up in presidential debates, I think people who spend their time and their energy trying to push for big policy changes, they know that they'll need to keep pushing for that, keep pushing for national focus on that, because there will always be something that feels more pressing, even though this is the existential issue of our lifetime.
Okay, Rebecca, it's been really good to talk to you. Thank you very much for coming on the air with us today.
Thanks so much.
That's Rebecca Hersher, reporter on NPR's Science Desk, where she covers outbreaks, natural disasters, environmental and health research. Well, stay with us because coming up, we're going to look at what New Hampshire's candidates for governor are saying about climate policies in the state. Keep it right here. This is The Exchange on NHPR. This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today, as part of NHPR's By Degrees Climate Reporting Project, we're looking at how the candidates for New Hampshire governor are talking about climate change. And listeners, as always, we want to hear from you. How do you hear the gubernatorial candidates discussing climate? What policies make the most sense to you here at the state level? Our email is exchange@nhpr.org. You can comment on Facebook or you can call in 1-800-892-6477. And along with NHPR Energy and Climate reporter Annie Ropeek, we're joined now by Jeff Feingold, editor at New Hampshire Business Review. Jeff, it's great to have you back on The Exchange. Thank you very much.
It's great to be here, Laura. Thanks for inviting me.
Well, what do you think, Jeff, of the attention that energy policy, besides the pandemic, energy policy has received a lot of attention in the New Hampshire governor's race this year. I wonder what you think. Yeah,
you could argue that if it wasn't for COVID, that energy would be probably at the top of the agenda. Maybe energy and healthcare are the two big issues that are facing New Hampshire right now. And it's interesting that it's still able to get out of the cacophony over the coronavirus, even in all this. And it was an issue, obviously, in the Democratic primary between Andy Valinsky and Dan Feltes, and now it's become an issue also in the general election campaign. You know, in New Hampshire, it's energy has been a major part of the discussion for many years, whether it's just business in the business community itself or just regular people. You just have to look at your electric bill every month. And it's just not going away. I think that part of it has to do really with the idea that New Hampshire is so dependent on other places for its energy that it's become, you know, it's ingrained in us to worry about it, to think about it, because we seem to have not really been able to grab a hold of the issue and really try to, you know, get control of it.
Oh, that's interesting, Jeff. So the climate issue here in New Hampshire is intertwined with the fact that we have relatively high energy costs, Jeff. Is that it?
Yes, absolutely. Absolutely. And it drives a lot of stuff. Now, one of the interesting things is that, you know, in New Hampshire, we have been making some progress on getting some independence on this, you know, especially when it comes to energy conservation and it also in just investments in things like solar energy and others. It's just not as dynamic in our economy as it is in other economies, even in bordering states.
Sure, lots of solar in Vermont and Massachusetts, for example. Annie, are the gubernatorial candidates as far apart from each other on energy and climate policy as the presidential candidates are, which we talked about in our earlier segment? Go ahead, Annie.
Definitely not. Just generally, they are, you know, much more sort of in line with just mainstream debate on climate policy. I think we'll talk a little bit about, you know, whether Governor Sununu believes in climate change. If we were having this conversation, you know, in his first campaign, even 2 or 3 years ago, this would be a little different. He has sort of moved on how he talks about climate science away from some skeptic language and more toward accepting science, saying that he accepts that humans are causing climate change and looking more at sort of his conservative ideas about what we should do about it. And, you know, I think we've sort of moved past whether that's really the debate here, whereas in the national picture, we are still in that debate. You know, President Trump has continued to deny climate science. He did so in California during the wildfires. So it makes it hard to have sort of as granular of a debate as we've had on this issue in New Hampshire, because you have to just deal with the basic premise in addition to the policy details. You know, that being said, these two candidates, Governor Sununu and Dan Feltes, have very different philosophies on what to do about this. They have fought tooth and nail on various policy solutions. They have different sets of facts that they appear to be working with on a lot of these issues. So there's a lot of daylight between them, but certainly not as much as there is between Trump and Biden.
Well, lots of emails coming in. Go ahead, Jeff, real quick.
I just wanted to say that I think one of the big differences is that I think that the governor seems to prefer the idea of generating more power outside of, you know, fossil fuels. Like, for instance, he embraces this idea of offshore wind, which could be a major investment and be a big help in terms of fighting climate change and generating electricity just for New Hampshire. And, you know, as we know, he supported Northern Pass and other similar kind of projects. But also, I think that I don't think he has really embraced the idea of energy conservation, which by all accounts would be a major help in helping reduce our electricity use and costs over the years. I think that's a big thing. I mean, that's one of the differences between the governor and Senator Feltes.
Sure.
Yeah, and listeners want to know about electric generation, peak energy, housing, also this whole solar debate that Sununu and Feltes have had. So let's go to their questions and to Cynthia, who's calling in from Dover first. Hi, Cynthia. Thanks for being with us today. Go ahead.
Hi. Yes, in our region, we lost a job opportunity and a big project for solar in a larger sense, and because of because of Sununu's many vetoes and net metering, you know, cut off that capacity for us to generate our own energy here. So Feltes, in contrast, is supporting net metering and opening up our state for more solar and renewable energy jobs. Can the speakers explain how the net metering issue relates to having more jobs and more renewable energy locally?
Well, I'm so glad you called, Cynthia. And Susan in Durham also wanted to know about this. Susan says, are you able to fact check claims made by the candidates? I've heard Governor Sununu claim that many of the climate-related bills he vetoed would have cost New Hampshire residents millions. Susan says, is this true? And he has claimed that he's been the leader among New England states in getting us offshore wind power. Are these claims true? How can we fact check candidates' claims? It's a job, Susan, I'll tell you that, in terms of fact checking the claims. But to you, Jeff, and you too, Annie. Annie, you first, please. Just untangle this whole solar energy, net metering. The governor's claim that the net metering bills he received would cost low-income Granite Staters a lot of money. Feltes' argument, no, that's not true. We could spend a whole hour on this, Annie, but I'm asking you to just sum it up, please.
Yes, we have spent many hours on this.
Yes,
I will
we
just
have.
Quickly, to address Susan's question about whether we can fact check that Sununu says we've been a leader on offshore wind, that one's a lot easier to answer. And the answer is that we were the last New England state to ask for a federal task force on offshore wind development, which means we were sort of the last, you know, piece of the puzzle that got that going. So in that way, we were a leader. In another way, we were behind the curve on that issue. Our neighbor states, you know, had been working on it for longer, but New Hampshire has really tried to take the lead on this. We hosted the first meeting on that issue. You know, they're really excited about it. And so they're trying to be a big player on that topic, which, you know, it's a regional issue, but certainly can't get it done without New Hampshire. And so, you know, we are participating in that quite actively. Now, to net metering, the short answer is it's very hard to fact check some of these numbers that get tossed around. I have tried to ask the Sununu campaign to tell me where they get some of these numbers. They do not answer those questions. The Public Utilities Commission says it's very hard to determine the effect of net metering on rates, on people's energy costs, the energy companies themselves. And sorry, let me just define net metering for us. This is when consumers can make their own energy, usually with solar, say rooftop solar. They make their own energy, and whatever they don't use, they can sell back to the grid. And there are limits on how much they can sell back to the grid. They would either get that money from that as a credit off their bills, or they might get at some actual profit off of that. And, you know, the argument is that this costs other people money because it, you know, kind of takes the form of a subsidy. This just really, as far as we can tell, is not true. The Public Utilities Commission has said they can't tell for sure. The utilities have said, you know, it can have an effect on rates, but it's certainly not the biggest effect. The Sununu campaign has not confirmed for me any of the numbers that they have said about the cost of this. If they would like to do so, I welcome their emails. And so this has become a big sticking point in this race. You know, the idea of just use of solar power as a subsidy is somewhat unfounded. And so, you know, I also think, and we'll talk about this, that net metering is certainly not the like biggest problem that we have when it comes to fighting climate change. It's become a huge sticking point in this race. But other advocates I've talked to have said in the time, the years we've spent debating net metering, we've sort of moved past where this would have been as big a help as it's made out to be now.
And
we
need
bigger steps now. So it's controversial on all sides. And you know, it's very hard to get to the bottom of it.
Well, just to give listeners a flavor of what this sounds like, let's hear a little bit from the exchanges debate with Governor Sununu and Senator Feltes, where they talk about this net metering issue and solar power. Let's hear.
The vetoes of clean energy, solar, distributed generation, energy efficiency have resulted in rates going up on everyday Granite Staters.
That's absolutely not true. Hundreds of
That's
millions
absolutely
of dollars.
True.
It's not like a couple bucks here, Dan. It's hundreds of millions.
And these are bipartisan pieces of legislation.
Okay, and that sounds like another show that we will have to do also after the election. Back to our listeners, both of you. And Barbara in Goffstown writes, I recently watched the movie Burned, Our Trees, the New Coal, which addressed the massive forest destruction in the U.S., particularly in our southeast, to ship pellets to Europe for electricity production, which actually increases pollution. Barbara says, pellets are not made from low-quality wood/rotherwood waste. They're made from newly cut good trees. She says, we have two such pellet plants here in New Hampshire, one in Berlin, one on the seacoast. This is not sustainable. We hear support of biomass from Jean Shaheen as well as the Forest Society. But Barbara says she's of the opinion there's a big difference between sustainable biomass and what is happening in Berlin. She'd like to hear some comments. And Jeff, can you address biomass? Boy, we haven't talked about this in a long time, but some people see it as a climate solution and other people like Barbara do not.
Well, it's a climate solution when you put it in perspective with other, you know, with fossil fuels, I guess. The main thing about biomass in New Hampshire is that it's a definitely a remedy or somewhat of a remedy to the really devastation that the North Country economy in particular went through with, you know, just the loss of the paper industry, paper and pulp industry. And it's really a way of helping out the forestry industry, the timber industry in New Hampshire. I mean, there's no getting around that. I mean, it's still on this, in the scheme of things, it's not the most environmentally friendly way of producing energy. What it is actually a way of helping to just give New Hampshire a little bit more independence in terms of its energy, make in the kind of energy it does have it in the generation picture, and, you know, and just how things are put together that way.
Well, in terms of net metering, Jeff, and this biomass question that our listener writes, I have a broader question. What's the convergence, Jeff, of business and climate here in New Hampshire? What clean energy sectors are looking to expand here in New Hampshire, no matter who wins the governor's race?
Well, you see, I think that's a really good question. Now, we have seen, even in this era of COVID, still pretty robust energy sector in terms of employment, in terms of economic activity. We have seen there's about 17,000 jobs that have been created in the state related to clean energy. And a lot of them, as I said earlier, were related to energy conservation. But there's also a couple of thousand, I believe, in solar. There's about 1,500 even now in terms of wind, in terms of some of those wind projects we've seen up there. And it's still a pretty dynamic sector. It's one of the big arguments in favor of net metering and expanding net metering is that it would probably result in the creation of even more jobs because there'll be more larger renewable energy projects built. You know, that's one of the things about the net metering issue. It makes it for shorthand we say solar, but it's pretty much for most renewable energy projects. Would be benefited by net metering. So that's something else to think about. But really, in terms of jobs, New Hampshire has about 3% of the workforce before COVID was related to clean energy, which is, you know, pretty good compared to the nation, but nowhere near as good as, like, let's say, Vermont, Massachusetts. So we still have a little ways to go in terms of where we stand in the region, but we are kind of moving in the right direction when it comes to that.
Interesting. Andy, go ahead.
Yeah, I just wanted to jump in on that. One thing I thought is really interesting about how our clean energy jobs have changed or not changed during COVID is that we've seen in states like Massachusetts, when the pandemic hit, they lost thousands of solar jobs, thousands of energy efficiency jobs, because they had way more of those jobs to begin with. New Hampshire has been, according to a research firm that's been following this, that's been doing some really interesting data on this topic, BW Research, we've been one of the most stagnant states on our clean energy employment, which is good in one sense. We haven't lost a ton of jobs. We haven't gained a ton of jobs back, though, because we don't have that many jobs relative to other states. And the sector is, as Jeff said, you know, moving a lot more in neighbor states, including Maine, just under their Governor Janet Mills. You know, she has taken a stagnant climate change state under former Governor Paula Page and run with it. And now solar power is really rapidly growing there. And companies in New Hampshire that also work in Maine have told me that they've only survived the pandemic because of their business in Maine, not because of their business in New Hampshire, because there isn't a ton of it. And it's really sort of, it's capped by some of these net metering issues that have been vetoed. And also by, maybe more importantly, our renewable portfolio standard, which dictates how much renewable energy the utilities have to use. Our cap or our goal for solar use in that standard is extremely low. and is not getting any higher because the governor has vetoed efforts to expand that. So we have the lowest renewable energy use goal in the region, the lowest solar goal in the region. And unless that changes, there's not a lot of hope for, you know, companies to really be incentivized to invest in solar expansion here, at least not as much, as Jeff has said, as we've seen in neighboring states. And that is a lost economic opportunity, potentially.
That's interesting. That's
exactly,
so in states,
Annie's absolutely yeah, go ahead, right, Jeff. About that. And another thing is that in terms of the clean tech energy, which is what they call themselves, the clean energy in this sector, is that there has been growth. That you have to remember that. We have seen growth here. Actually, just the other day, you know, Annie had a story about how NextEra Energy, which is the owner of the Seabrook Nuclear Power Plant, got approval for this massive solar project in Fitzwilliam that, you know, it's the first of its kind in New Hampshire, and it's a big deal for New Hampshire, but it's also not, it's just the first. I mean, we lag behind related to other states in the region and elsewhere in terms of having these massive solar projects that can be built, that can be cost effective, that are actually competitive in
and
many
Jeff,
ways.
And Jeff, I have to cut you off there, but I have to say there's three or four emails from
the
listeners
back
that
for, because
yeah,
even though
I got to cut you off, Jeff,
bipartisan support for these.
I got to cut you off there, Jeff, but the enthusiasm from our listeners for this topic makes me feel like we should look again at renewable energy down the line, because a lot of people did want to weigh in on this. Jeff and Annie, thank you very much for being with us this hour. And today's show was produced by Exchange producer Jessica Hunt. This is The Exchange on NHPR.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals and not those of NHPR, its Board of Trustees, or its underwriters. If you liked what you heard, spread the word. Give us a review on Apple Podcasts to help other listeners find us. And thanks.